its staff, or management. Thanks for listening, and enjoy Radio Free Brooklyn. This is what Brooklyn sounds like.
Hey, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. I'm in such a good mood today. I don't know why exactly. I feel really wound up, so I'm going full bore, okay? I hope you can tolerate it. Excuse me if I get really annoying. But anyway, thanks so much for listening. You know, I'm Dr. Lisa, the self-proclaimed psychotherapist, blah, blah, blah. It's exciting that you're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn because it is the greatest radio station in the continental USA, Europe, and all of Japan. But anyway, the thing about a really nonprofit, running a nonprofit, being part of a nonprofit is like we really are running on a shoestring. And we are very community based. We do a lot out in the community. We are a very idealistic group. And you should go to our radios, check out our station at radiofreebrooklyn.org. And definitely check out the donate page and you can get yourself some merch. We have over 70 shows of every kind. And we have like really an amazing roster of expert hosts. So if you like this, you can't not find anything that you can't not find something. Whatever I'm saying. I got too, like I said, I don't know why I'm so wound up. I have this particularly special guest today, an amazing artist who is extremely well respected and devoted to his practice, Eric Doringer. And I'm going to bring him on in 1 second, but I'm going to push a few things that I'm doing too. How's that? Before we get Eric on. But the things that I'm doing that you must come and see this. I did this really awesome installation with a sex doll that I actually got from a therapist whose clients are men that are transitioning from sex dolls to real people. So she had an extra doll and she gave it to me. And the installation is an artist in her art studio who makes a living as a stripper. And we have photographs of her at Pumps, which is 1089 Grand Street, the greatest exotic dancing bar in five boroughs. I'm going to say five boroughs, okay? And then and she has all this artwork that she makes about how she feels about men, about her job, about the hypocrisy of being a female artist and being, you know, paying for things, shit like that, how you guys treat her, all that shit. So that's at 56 Bogart Street here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And there's an artist talk this Saturday, 4 to 6. Okay. And then also, most importantly, I got to get the fucking fannies in the seat. I want your fanny in my seat. I'm doing a live show called Stand Up, Lie Down at the City Reliquary, which is an incredibly small, incredible museum in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And I am going to be doing some speed therapy on two comedians, Christian Finnegan, can you believe it? And also Shakir Stanley, who's amazing. I've got two amazing comedians. They're going to do their sets, and then I'm going to do therapy on them. And I also have an incredible visual artist who's going to make a presentation of her work, Tara Lewis, who just did this huge project because Brooke Shields wanted her to do portraits of her and her daughter. So it's going to be a great show, and that's in June 9th. At 7 p.m., City Reliquary. Go to go to my Facebook page, my Instagram, Dr. Lisa. It'll all be on there. Okay. There, I did all that. So let's bring in our guest, Eric Doringer. I've been going off, so I have to introduce him. Let's see. I'm looking at him right now. We're on Zoom. We traded houses in last fall. Me and my husband, him and his wife. They were in New York. We were in L.A. Their dog is smaller than ours, and our dog is 4 pounds. But anyway, Eric is a really, I have so much respect for Eric and his work. And it is like, I'm going to let him explain it. He does appropriation work. He is very, very, very well known among art people. He is in all sorts of major collections. And the thing about Eric, he's also a really nice, decent human being. And he's been on the show a lot, and I am so proud every time he's on the show. So I am going to turn it over to Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hey, Lisa. Excuse me.
Okay. We got to get you a little bit louder.
Yeah. Testing. Yeah. 1, 2, 1, 2. Can you hear
me?
Yeah,
I can hear you, but can you get a little closer to the mic or something?
Oh, I'm on this headphone mic. It should be. I don't think I can get much closer.
Really?
Am I too quiet? I can try doing the the laptop mic.
Yeah, let's give it a shot. Anyway, so Eric is doing this really special project that involves actually launching real, I guess, miniature rockets that he's made. It's just crazy. So I'm going to, let's try it again. Say something, Eric.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah. I'm going to really try turning up your thing. I think we'll be okay. We'll be okay.
I don't know. Can I?
We're good. We're good. I turned you up.
We're good. Okay,
we're good.
Cool.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about what your practice is.
Okay. So, yeah, I work with appropriation. The project that's probably best known that I did is I used to make these little what I call bootleg paintings, which were like knockoffs of all the hot art stars, like Damien Hirst and John Curran. And anyway, I would go out and sell these little paintings on the street in Chelsea, like outside of the galleries selling the real paintings. But, you know, mine were obviously a lot cheaper and they were small because they needed to be portable, fit in my suitcase and go around town. So that's kind of what I started off doing and how I kind of got best known, I guess, in the art world is just because I would be out there on Saturdays in Chelsea.
But you really met people like Jerry Saltz, who's a really famous art critic, is like when Eric actually has a genuine relationship with Jerry and his wife Roberta Smith, who writes for the Times. I think you're the only person I know personally that has an actual, they really admire your work personally.
Yeah, they were supportive from really early on. I mean, I would see Jerry because he was always out visiting the galleries and he was very enthusiastic about what I was doing and supportive. And they have bought some work for me over the years, which is nice.
You're pretty modest, but you're in a lot of collections and stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. Tell us, Eric. Come on. Get everybody excited.
I don't like to name names, but yeah, I mean, there are some celebrities and there are some art world people that.
And some museums. And your books, too. Your books.
Books, yeah.
Books are in MoMA.
And those are in museum collections like MoMA and New York Public Library and the Met. But yeah, not so much my art yet.
Okay. So he's really legitimate, guys. You see what I'm saying? And I know him. Okay.
I made those little paintings and sold them on the street for 10 years or so. And then, I mean, I still make them. I don't sell them on the street anymore. But I kind of moved into doing larger projects that were more like in the same scale and the same materials as the original artists. So, I mean, just to give your viewers an idea, like I did a show based on Andy Warhol, for example, where I redid a lot of the work that he did with products. So like the Campbell soup can paintings and the Brillo boxes and the Coke bottle paintings. But I made my paintings like the same look and the same size, and they were silkscreen, so the same technique, but they were with the contemporary products.
So you updated them.
Exactly. So I think it was 2015 or so, and it was like the
plastic bottles.
Exactly. Plastic Coke bottles and the, you know, the contemporary Brillo box, which was like a brown cardboard box, not the red, white, and blue one that we're all familiar with.
You kind of make them time travel. Like there's sort of like a historic, it's a really interesting process. There's like to see them. I mean, it's kind of like as if they come alive to you in the moment from the past, sort of.
Right, right. And for me, it's interesting too, because it's, you know, it's sort of like Warhol was painting the Campbell soup can that, you know, was on the shelf when he was, you know, in 1962 or whatever it was. And then, you know, I was painting the Campbell soup can that was on the shelf, you know, in my lifetime. And, how is that the same and how is that different?
Yes, exactly. And I also want to mention that one of the things that I find so fascinating, I actually was saying the other day that you're almost like an impersonator. Like if you had a... like somebody who can do an impersonation and their talent is such that they have like you're, except with you, it's art skills. Like you can pick any artist in that, as far as I can see, and make like an appropriation of their work in your vision that is like extremely well done. And you have, done every medium. You know, you've done sculpture. You've just tell us about, like, I mean, we don't have to get into the specifics of every single one, but just tell us some of the mediums that you have worked with.
I mean, it's really been everything: a painting, sculpture, photography, video,
silkscreen.
Silkscreen, yeah. I mean, it depends what the original work is, obviously, but I work across a lot of different media. And you know, I often have to learn some new kind of skill for like a new body of work that I'm doing.
But you seem like confident and as well you should be. I mean, I'm so impressed by this. Like you seem really confident taking on any project to make anything you want to make.
You know, I know my strengths and my limitations. So I choose things that I feel like I can do a good job making. You know, I'm not going to like try to paint a Da Vinci portrait. Like
well, this. you have a huge range of very refined skills, and I just want people to know that. So, okay, are we ready to discuss your current project that I'm very excited to talk about?
Yeah, so my current project is called the Eric Dorringer Rocket Factory, and it is inspired by a project by an artist named Tom Sachs, which is called the Tom Sachs Rocket Factory. And I should probably talk a little bit about Tom's work just for your listeners who might not be familiar with it.
Yeah, you might not know. I mean, well, these are people that I imagine in their basement, in their like parent, living in their parents' basement. So they better, it'll be good for them to like learn what's going on out in the world.
Well, it's all available on the internet too. So, So Tom Sachs is, you know, I mean, he is a superstar artist, much, much more famous than I am.
Well, probably. A lot richer. He's richer. He has a staff. Tell us how many people he has, like a little fact, literally like a staff.
Yeah, I mean, he has a studio, and I think, you know, the studio itself is kind of like one of his artworks, but he has, I don't know, I think at least 20 people that work for him, you know.
In New York City, right?
In New York City, yeah. Mm-hmm. So he, sort of first became famous, I guess, in the late 90s, doing some kind of controversial works. He made a bunch of guns, sort of out of things that you could find at the hardware store, and was selling them as sculptures, but they were also, you know, functioning illegal. I mean, you know, not registered or serial numbered guns. So that was sort of controversial. And he also early on did a lot of work with kind of luxury brand packaging. Like he made McDonald's value meals, but out of packaging for like Burberry's and Tiffany's and Prada and companies like that. And he also at that time did a model of a concentration camp that was all made out of Prada, you know, bags and boxes. And that was sort of controversial and got him some known.
Well, it's a very interesting concept.
Yeah. And he is a Jewish, you know, artist as well. So it's kind of interesting for that reason too. But, you know, since that time, his work has gotten much more elaborate. And, you know, like we said, he has this large studio that helps him, you know, like he recently did a project that was like these scale models of the World Trade Center that were something like, you know, two stories tall.
Wow, really? I didn't know about that. Well, he's kind of an appropriation artist as well, right? Which is really funny.
Is, yeah, and that's sort of, I think that's something that I've become more interested in, is this sort of idea of like a meta appropriation and, you know, like
Did you say made up or meta? What did you say? I didn't hear it.
Meta
appropriation, because you're appropriating like something that he's appropriating and
Right, which is sort of like the Warhol thing too, right? I mean, it's like Warhol didn't, you know, he didn't license the soup can from Campbell's. He just, you know, painted a soup can and said, this is mine.
Well, yeah. I mean, Prada, you think more of as a, I think soup cans seem a lot more, what's the word, mass produced or like less right, personal. More, but more I know what you mean. Yeah, okay.
But I, you know, I am sort of interested in, you know, remaking work that's already, you know, already appropriated from somewhere. Like I did a series based on Richard Prince's cowboy photographs where he had made these photographs where he photographed Marlboro advertisements, but kind of cropped them so you couldn't see any of the text, and they were just cowboys, but they were also very obviously, you know, Marlboro cowboys.
So your work really questions like who made this up?
Right. Like, so I redid that project and I found vintage copies of all the same ads that he photographed, and I photographed those ads myself and printed them at the same size. And, you know, how is that the same and how is that different?
Right. Which is really funny, really. Because
right.
It's so kind anyway, of like, so, yeah, where, yeah, you know, who owns the idea? Who owns, I mean, it is a really, you know, take some acid, guys. All right, get yourself some acid and check out Eric's work. There is a lot of levels to it, though, which is real, but funny. You know, funny and smart. That's funny and smart.
Yeah, like who owns Campbell's soup, right? I mean, Campbell's company obviously owns the trademark, but if you see a painting of a Campbell's soup can, you automatically think Andy Warhol. So
right, and then like. Are you allowed to reproduce it? Because it's art, but you couldn't reproduce it if you were going to sell gravy.
Right. Or then, you know, can you make a painting of it and then put that painting on a t-shirt?
Now, yeah.
These are all questions.
Yeah, it's great.
So going back to Tom Sachs and his Rocket Factory and my Rocket Factory, he opened his Rocket Factory, I think, probably about a year ago now. It's a project that sort of starts with NFTs and then becomes a physical sculpture. So he has a website, TomSachsRocketFactory.com. That's SACHS is how you spell Sachs. And on that website, I mean, it explains this project, but you can also buy these NFTs, which are rocket components. So the rockets have three pieces. There's a nose cone, there's the rocket body, and there's a tail assembly.
Just so people can understand what this looks like, it's kind of like when you're saying rocket, it's almost like a model, like a model that you would buy, like a plastic. I mean, it's
yeah, it's an Estes model rocket. So for anyone that ever did model rockets.
Oh, okay. It's a model rocket. Come from a model rocket. Okay. So you guys can picture this. All right.
Yeah. So the NFTs are drawings of the three pieces of a model rocket: the nose, the body, and the tail. And they're all branded with different brands that are meaningful to Tom Sachs, either brands he's worked with in his art or things that he uses in his daily life. Mm-hmm. So it's things like McDonald's and Chanel and Tiffany and Budweiser and Hello Kitty. So kind of really high and low brands. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. NASA is one of the brands. So he has enough components to make 1,000 rockets. And like I said, you know, there's like, you know, 5 NASA nose cones and 10 McDonald's bodies. And, you know, you can buy these different components as NFTs. And then you, once you have 3, you can burn the original NFTs and they will mint a new NFT, which is a completed rocket. Mm-hmm. So if you had, you know, a Chanel nose cone, a McDonald's body, and a Tiffany tail, then you get an mm-hmm. NFT of a rocket with those components.
It's kind of like when you go and if you want to buy like a pair of Nikes and you want like, you know, a green sole and a red top, right? And blue laces, you can pick it all out.
Right, exactly. Or,
Like that. Yeah, you can pick it all out or it can all be.
So basically you build your own rocket out of these different components. Mm-hmm. And it can be what's called a perfect rocket, which is when all 3 of the brands match, or it can be a Franken rocket, which is when there's 3 different brands. So, and it's also, it's kind of like the like McDonald's Monopoly game where you would need to like save up 3 coupons and then you would get like free hamburger or something like that. Like there's also, you know, it's like you need to save up these parts and build your rocket and then you get the complete rocket.
So if you get, okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. And then once you have that completed rocket NFT, there's a launch option. And what that means is basically that the studio will build a model rocket. It's about 12 inches tall and hand paint the different components to match the rocket that you design. So whatever nose cone, whatever body, whatever tail. And then they launch it somewhere and videotape the launch, and the video gets added to the NFT and kind of the, and then the rocket gets put in a display case and given to the person who owns the NFT. So the collector winds up with basically 3 things. They have the NFT of the rocket, they have the video of the rocket, and they have the sculpture of the rocket.
Hmm. So I think what's also clever, whatever you call it, about that is that it really spans, it really uses the NFT in a way that kind of goes back and forth between, you know, the meat world, the real world, and the NFT digital. It rides that line, right?
Right. It has both components, and in theory, at least, they're inseparable. So, you know, like you, if you're the collector, you know, you don't want to split them up. Like the actual artwork is what he calls the holy trinity of those 3 mm-hmm. objects. But, mm-hmm. you know, if this whole NFT thing goes bust in 5 years, you still have a sculpture. And if your sculpture burns up in a house fire, mm-hmm. you still have the NFT, you know.
Well, I think what's really interesting about it is that it really does involve the collector's participation.
That's right, because they're essentially designing the rocket, and Tom doesn't know ahead of time, you know, what the collectors are going to build.
Right, and also like they are involved in getting an NFT, and they are involved in like what's happening out in the real world, the activity of the launch, and then also they get to own something that happened. Like it's kind of like got so many different. It's a very active piece of art. It isn't like you go to a gallery, buy a painting and hang it up. You're very involved.
Yeah, and the collectors are actually invited to attend the launches if they want to. And then sometimes he'll like videotape them launching the rocket as part of the documentation. So then that becomes part of the NFT.
Oh, that's
so then
cool.
The collector is like inserted into it. So yeah, it's got a lot of levels of like involving the, you know, letting the collector play artist a little bit.
Collaboration, let's call it.
Right. So anyway, so my version of this project is the Eric Dorringer Rocket Factory. And You can see it online at ericdoringerrocketfactory.com. That's ericdoeringer rocketfactory.com. Essentially, my idea was to redo Tom's project, but on a smaller scale. So his rocket factory has enough components to make 1,000 rockets and has 24 different brands you can choose from. And I did sort of a smaller version where my factory, I chose 12 of the brands, the one that seemed kind of the most iconic. And there's basically two of each component. So that means there's enough to make 24 rockets total. Mm-hmm. So it's, mm-hmm. you know, again, it's a smaller endeavor than Tom's factory. But essentially, you know, I do the same thing that his studio is doing. I get the same type of rocket. I paint it up in a very similar way. It's the same brands. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's me painting them. So they're a little bit different. And originally I had planned to do NFTs as well and sell it, you know, in exactly the same mm-hmm. manner. So again, like this was something that was new for me. I had never made an NFT before. I didn't really know anything about,
the NFT world. Huge undertaking, all of that.
So I had a couple guys that were helping me who were more knowledgeable about that space and knew about coding and things.
Yeah, because I don't think the public, I was surprised when I found this out, and I don't even understand it that well, but like in order to actually make an NFT, they call that minting an NFT. That's very complex. Like you can't just like make a JPEG and post it and say that's an NFT. There's a big process, and I think it costs money to make an NFT. You can't just, so I'm just saying, I just want you guys to know that like, it's complicated to make an NFT. Am I right about that, Eric?
Well, it's not super complicated. And, you know, it's like once someone showed me how to do it, it was fairly straightforward. But, you know, you do need to like have a crypto wallet. And then, you know, like my bank wouldn't let me transfer the money to the crypto account. You know, like, there was all this. There are definitely a bunch of hoops.
And it costs money to mint an NFT, right?
It does. I mean, it depends where you mint it, how much that is, and the site that I was using, it was only a few dollars. So
okay. But like Tom Sachs' site, does it cost a lot?
I think where he did it, it cost more like $100.
Yeah.
Okay. But you know, these things all fluctuate.
We're all learning. I'm learning.
So I had these guys that were helping me and kind of showed me what to do and helped me with, you know, figuring out a lot of the details and stuff. But then I actually went and I minted the first few NFTs using this website called Objkt, OBJKT.com. And, you know, I minted a few of them. And the next day I went to kind of look at them and, you know, I was going to mint some more and my account was blocked. And I kind of didn't really understand what that meant, but you know, eventually I reached out to, you know, customer service and, you know, I mean, I assumed it was a copyright issue, but I didn't know if it was like Tom Sachs or if it was one of the brands, you know, cause there was no, I didn't get a notice or anything.
Right.
It was locked. So I contacted customer service and they told me basically that it was a preemptive takedown, meaning like no one complained, but just they flagged it themselves. And it was because it was too similar to Tom Sachs's project.
But it's not because it had like a Tiffany logo. It was all about Tom Sachs's project or any of those brands, Tiffany, Budweiser.
That's what they said. I mean, I didn't know because it could have been either. And what they said is that it was Tom Sachs. They were like, it's.
But Tom Sachs didn't complain, did he?
No, he didn't complain. It was kind of just, you know, it's like if you upload a video to YouTube that has like, you know, the music of the Beatles on it, they're going to take it down before, you know, Apple Records contact them. They just have software.
It's kind of creepy how they can like figure that out, right?
Well, I was actually surprised. I mean, it sort of made me feel like there actually were humans behind this whole thing because, I mean, I'm sure that there is software that flags it, but then someone has to look at it and like be like, yeah, we're flagging this. And it actually kind of surprised me that it happened so quickly.
Which is so interesting, because that's something that as an appropriation artist, and you are expert in it, it's something that you wouldn't have learned, you wouldn't know unless you had actually gone out and gone down that road, right?
Yeah, and it's not, I mean, you know, because I, when it happened, I was sort of like, you know, what country's copyright laws do I have to comply with, you know, because it's like, it's the internet, and like, these laws are different everywhere. And in the US, we have something called fair use in copyright law, which is kind of what I rely on for much of my work. And, you know, that would in theory allow me to do this, but not if the company that's hosting it says no, you know.
That's sort of interesting.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, what they said is, first of all, I guess there's an issue in the NFT world around sort of forgery, and, you know, someone can make an NFT and say like, hey, this is a Tom Sachs NFT, and then you buy it and you find out it's not. So, you know, I understand that this is an actual problem that they have to deal with, you know, but I also think that they're just, you know, they're not knowledgeable about appropriation art so much in that world. And it's, you know, it's just it's different than the art world, you know, things that would fly don't fly.
Right.
So anyway, so what they told me was that I needed to get permission from Tom Sachs if I wanted to, you know, do these NFTs. And I thought about it because, you know, I have met Tom a couple of times. He's generally been supportive. And, you know, I thought that he probably would give me permission if I asked. But I sort of don't generally ask for permission with things. And I wasn't really sure how I felt about, you know, doing it.
Do you feel like if you ask for permission, then it becomes like it kind of taints it, because it becomes more of a collaboration? Or...
Well, there's that. There's also just like, you know, what if they do say no, then I really, you know, can't do it in good faith. Or, you know, what if they say, yeah, you can do it, but you have to do this or that or the other thing.
Also, once you start putting that into your practice, then you're in the position of asking everyone, and it's not your practice anymore. I mean, or it kind of puts a whole, it puts an opening in your practice that I don't think is desirable.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I just want to be free to do what I do. Yeah. And, you know, there's that saying, it's better to ask forgiveness than permission. You know, that's
you know, I've thought about that a few times. Is that good or not? But yeah.
And I was also, you know, I was also worried, you know, it was sort of like, I felt pretty confident that I could get permission from Tom, but it was like, well, then are they going to get permission from Apple and Nike and Chanel and Tiffany? And, you know, I didn't want to have to contact
these
companies and wade through their legal teams.
Right. And just so the listeners know, like, because Tom Sachs, his work is worth minimum six figures, these luxury brands and almost any brand has a lot. It's a lot easier for them to say, yeah, let's work with him. And you've told me they've commissioned him. Some brands have actually commissioned him, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think when Tom started out, it was all kind of done on the down low, you know, and he didn't ask permission. And I don't really know now, like, whether he licenses.
Yeah, it's just a different situation.
But yeah, I mean, like, Prada designs the uniforms for his studio now, and they did a big exhibition of his work at their foundation in Europe.
Yeah. It's so easy for him. Look at him. He's got a big factory. He's got 20 people working for him. There's money in it. The brands love him. It's so much easier to do it his way. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Jesus.
But, you know, I do it my way, and that's,
yeah, so it's good, more authentic. I'm saying that.
Yeah, but
okay. Well, it's all part of the same big bundle of art. Go ahead.
Yeah. So what I decided in the end was to scrap the whole NFT component of my project, because it just sort of started getting too complicated. And, you know, I guess I was just worried about roadblocks. You know, it's like, I could have gone to another website to mint them, but then what if the same thing happens? Or, you know, what if it happens a month after I have the website up? You know, and it just, there was a lot of stuff that seemed like it could go wrong with the NFTs.
Yeah, and I also, you know, as an artist, I think it's really important that people understand that, like, you're one, I think you do pretty well selling and making money as an artist. And I know you have a swimming pool in LA and everything, but the truth is, that one person, no matter how successful, doing all that work by themselves, has to choose what they're going to focus on carefully, because if you put 5 years into this, that means that, well, it'd be awful, but you wouldn't be developing your work.
Right.
Sure. It's just not worth it. Not worth it at all.
Yeah. So anyway, I kind of pivoted, and instead of NFTs, on my website, I'm selling what I'm calling EDRFTs, which stands for Eric Doringer Rocket Factory Token. And they're essentially, they function the same way as the NFTs do in Tom's project, but they're actually like a signed print. So it's kind of like the JPEG that you would have gotten with the NFT. You now get a piece of paper. So if you buy a nose cone, you know, I will print it out and sign it and send it to you. And then once you have the three component EDRFTs, you send them back to me, I destroy them, and I make the completed rocket EDRFT, which again is like a drawing of the rocket that you've designed. And then there's also the launch option, so you can get the sculptural rocket in the box, and I will launch it and document it with a video and all that stuff.
So I want to hear about the launch. So, I mean, this is a brand new project. You just launched it like last week, but have you sold enough or sold any to do, has anybody bought a launch?
No one has bought a launch yet, but you know, I did.
You did a test.
A proof of concept. I did a test. And actually, I mean, this whole project started because I really liked Tom's project, and I sort of considered like trying to get one of the rockets that he was doing, but I couldn't really figure out how much I was going to have to pay for it, and like I didn't have cryptocurrency, and I never yeah. pulled the trigger on getting his rocket. But then I was like, oh, you know, I could just make one. You know, then I was like, oh, well, I could actually make a bunch of them. So that was sort of the starter. So I did make one for myself that also served as the test rocket.
Mm-hmm. Is that the Cathay Che one?
That's the Cathay Che one. Named
that's Eric's wife, guys.
My wife and muse.
and muse.
It's a Chanel rocket. Her initials are CC, which is, of course, the Chanel logo.
Right.
So that one's mine, but that's the one that has been launched. So if you go on the website and you click on rockets, you can see the EDRFT of that and the video of it launching and a photo of it. And, you know, that's what you'll be getting if you yourself invest
in a
rocket.
What was that like? Like, how did you figure out that part? And was it influenced by what Sachs did? Or how did you figure that out? I mean, launching rockets, that's crazy. Can't you get arrested? What happened there?
Well, I did. I had a little bit of experience launching rockets as a kid. There was 1 year in summer camp that there was like an elective to do rocketry. So we built rockets and launched them. So, you know, I had done it before. I knew the basic principle and the, you know, the parts that you needed. And I essentially, you know, looked through the model rockets that were available until I found the one that matched, you know, the ones that Tom was using. And, you know, then it's just a kit. So it's, you know, if you're an artist, it's not that hard of a thing to build.
No, it's not that hard. Or like, well, I guess kids do it. So it comes with all the, you didn't have to figure out how to like get a rocket launched.
Not really. But, you know, then the actual, what they call the engine, which is sort of like it's almost like a firework, you know, it's a pyrotechnic device. Those you have to buy separately because, you know, they have to ship them in some explosive safe manner. And, you know, that is, you know, that's what makes it go. And that's kind of the fun part.
It's starting to sound dangerous. You could put an eye out.
Like setting off fireworks, you know. It's, mean, you do it electronically rather than with a lit fuse, but it's the same principle. It's, you know, gunpowder.
So what was that like? So you, what did you do? You drove it to a desert or something, right? I saw an image of it.
It's kind of funny. So, you know, when I was a kid, you could kind of just go like to a parking lot or a football field or something like that to do it. It turns out that California has pretty much the strictest laws in the country about model rocketry.
Thank God.
So, I mean, obviously we have fire issues here, but you basically have to like get the permission of the fire marshal in writing in advance and, you know, all this kind of stuff. So, when I did the test launch, I actually just drove out to the desert and, you know, found a spot where there was no one around and no power lines. And,
how far was that? Was it really far or like,
well, you know, we tied it into a larger trip. So we went out to, Desert Hot Springs for a weekend.
And, sounds, you know, great.
While we were out there, we launched the rocket. So it was a couple hours away.
Was it fun? Was it hard to do? Like, how did it go?
Oh, it was totally fun. I mean, it's
yeah, it must be
getting off a rocket. You know, what's not fun about that?
Did you do it manually?
Yeah, well, it's that you have kind of like a electronic device. So there's, you know, you essentially push a button. It's kind of like the nuclear bomb. It's like you have to hold in one switch and then you push a button.
Ooh, it sounds cool.
Yeah,
how
fun.
So you
high.
How hot, like, did it what happened when it went off? Like, what was that like? Like, did it go really high or far or did you get it back? What happened there?
It went pretty high. You know, they have a parachute, which is supposed to deploy and help them fall safely to Earth. And mine, the parachute popped out of the rocket, but it didn't really fully open. So it had a bit of a hard landing, but, you know, it was fine. It was the desert. Yeah. So it just fell in some sand.
How far away did you see it fall? Did you have trouble finding it?
There was no trouble finding it. It was a bit windy that day, but, you know, probably, was maybe 20 yards away from where we launched it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It wasn't too bad.
That sounds fun.
Yeah. And then I actually went to one of Tom's rocket launches.
Mm-hmm. Tom Sachs, the artist who, yeah.
Yeah, so he's basically been doing launches all across the country and I think a couple international ones because he's got 1,000 rockets to launch. So he did one that was sort of out near Joshua Tree, about 2.5 hours outside of L.A. And I drove out there for that. And it actually was interesting because where he did it is kind of like the closest like model rocket spot to Los Angeles, which is a dry lake bed. So there's nothing growing there. It's just sand and it's owned by the Federal Bureau of Land Management. So you don't need the fire marshal's permission because it's federal land instead of state land.
So he's got that down too.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's where Tom did. He launched, I think, 150 rockets the day that I went.
Oh my God. I didn't realize that. Wow. Oh my God. What was that like? Did they go off one after another or like, how did it work out? How many people?
Had,
that must have been
they
insane.
I think they had like 4 launching stations set up and, you know, his team would like prepare them. Then he would kind of go down the line launching them. And, you know, there were probably about 10 collectors that owned them that showed up to like launch their own rocket. You know, I was there for a couple hours, but I think Tom was probably there for the full day, you know, like 8 hours or 10 hours, you know, setting off rockets.
It's 10 an hour if you're lucky. Yeah. Wow. So that must have been really funny. So you saw like, I'm picturing like men in suits, like very, you know, uppity guys launching toy rockets.
They did have a uniform, not jackets, but like pants and a white shirt and a tie.
So you had to wear a uniform or they had to wear a uniform?
Just the studio, the staff.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. But it was pretty co-ed. There were quite a few
chick launchers.
Quite a few ladies. Actually, I don't think Tom basically did all of the launching, like the pushing of the launch button, right, except for the collectors who got to launch their own. So the staff was not actually launching. They were setting everything up.
Sure. And so you know Tom. You've known him for, tell me about like seeing Tom. You saw Tom, and how long have you known him?
I've met him a few times over the years, and he's always been cool to me, and I think he owns a piece of mine. So I was pretty sure that he would be cool about this project. He had liked some posts on Instagram that I had done about it. And yeah, I saw him out there and I was like, hey, I'm Eric. I'm the guy from the other Rocket Factory. And he gave me a hug and he was like, oh yeah, I love what you're doing. So,
oh, it's great.
Yeah, it was totally cool.
That's great. You know, guys, a lot of artists, if Eric appropriates your work, it's a huge compliment. I mean, he really, it means you've made it. A lot of artists do. A lot of big artists actually feel that way. I know that for sure. So it's kind of he takes it as a compliment, I'm guessing.
He does. But, you know, I mean, it's not something I can take for granted. And I have had artists that have threatened to sue me. And, you know, so it's.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us about one of those?
I don't really want to get into.
There's a famous artist, though. I think I know one, and I'm not going to say. But I mean, there is people that don't need the money that are just kind of vindictive. I don't understand why somebody would sue you because these guys are also. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the case of these artists, they feel like I'm stealing their work, which I can understand how someone would feel that way. I mean, it's disappointing to me and it's frustrating. And
it's disappointing to me. Like, don't artists if you're making art and you're selling your art for that much money, you should understand like the value of or the importance or the necessity. Like, it adds a very important part to the dialogue of art appropriation. And there are a lot of it's an area of art that has been around forever, right? There's a lot of famous appropriation artists.
Well, I mean, there's certainly a lot of famous appropriation artists. I mean, I think appropriation art as a named thing is kind of a phenomenon of, you know, since the 80s. But, you know, what does it mean to appropriate? I mean, in a sense, if you're painting a landscape, aren't you appropriating the landscape? Like, it's...
Right, and that's what's so great... Yeah, but that's what's so great about the whole idea of it. Conceptually, it's a fascinating idea because it just begs the question of what did you originate and what does it mean to originate something? And if you originate something, what's your ownership over it? And this is not just, this could be, you could use the same questions about chicken soup recipes.
That's true. And actually, recipes are quite contentious in copyright law because you cannot copyright a chicken soup recipe.
Huh?
So you write a cookbook and you tell a little story about chicken soup and you draw a chicken, you can copyright all that stuff, but you can't actually copyright the recipe.
I didn't know that. You know quite a bit about this copyright stuff, don't you?
I do. But, you know, the frustrating thing is it almost doesn't. I mean, it matters that I know it, but when it comes down to it, in my own personal experience, you know, you can't fight a millionaire, you know? I can say, oh yeah, there's this fair use thing and it's totally legal what I'm doing and I'm transforming your thing. But, you know, if you stick your lawyers on me, there's not a whole lot I can do.
Right. So have you ever had anybody, like any well-known artists, go like, when are you going to appropriate my work? I mean, you're pretty well-known. Have you ever had anything like that?
I have. I mean, usually it's not the well-known artists. Like when I was selling these little bootleg paintings out in Chelsea, all the time someone would be like, oh, you should paint my painting. You know? But they were rarely anyone that you've heard of.
Yeah, because usually the paintings that you were selling were recognizable.
Yeah, I did actually hear a story, though, about an artist who was upset that I hadn't copied their work.
Really? Somebody successful?
Yeah, like, you're like, aren't I as famous as this other person?
Yeah, it is. Richard Prince knows that you've copied his work, right?
Yeah.
Have you had contact with him?
I've never had any direct contact with him. No, like I've, you know, I know some people that work with him or for him and stuff like that, but I've never actually had a conversation with Richard. He does own some of my work.
Yeah. He did. So he bought your work. That's more.
Well, he didn't. I think someone gave it to him. I don't think he actually bought it. But,
Wow, you're really, you know, see, that's what I was telling you guys. Eric's the real deal. Like, he could have just said yes, but instead he told you the truth. No, someone gave it to him. How are you going to, we're promoting your work, Eric. No, just kidding.
Oh, yeah. Richard's been a collector for ages.
He's
hundreds of pieces.
So, I think one of the things, and if listeners are interested, they can go back and look through the archives. I'll post them when I post this episode. But we've talked about your processes before, particularly about something like the Ankhwara one, where it was really where you appropriated the work. It really took over your life. I mean, it's so interesting because I don't think people understand the level of really its performance in that you are literally doing the process that they are doing, and it takes whatever it takes. Like, if you have to learn something, you learn it. If you have to travel somewhere, you'll travel there. So what was the experience like? Tell us a little bit about the experience that you had learned.
I think you know, one of the things that really interested me and got me excited about the Rocket Factory is the fact that, like, this is a project that the original artist Tom Sachs is, like, doing right now. You know, like he's still building rockets. You could still buy one and launch it, you know, if you wanted to. And, you know, I mean, typically when I make art, it's like something that was made, you know, at least 20 years ago. But this was sort of like, oh, this is happening now. And, like, I can, you know, I can go to a launch, I can launch my own rocket at the same time that he's launching a rocket. So, you know, there was kind of something about that was really exciting. Like, the fact that, like, this is a new project for the both of us. And, like, neither one of us really knows how it's going to unfold. And
wow.
And again, I mean, thinking about copyright, it's like, you know, like, Tom doesn't know how people are going to combine the components and make his rocket.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, someone might make one with a Chanel nose and McDonald's body, or they might not, you know, and same thing with me. Like, my rocket might be a complete copy of one of his rockets, or it might be a rocket that never got built. You know?
Oh, that is really cool. So they're evolving in real time because the process is so interactive with the collector, which is really fascinating.
Right. There's a part of it that's kind of out of the artist's
right.
And like, who knows?
And the story's being written as we speak.
Right. And if we talked about copyright infringement with these, you know, is it like, it's infringing on his copyright if he's made the same rocket, and it's not if he hasn't.
Like, yeah, it's fascinating.
And, you know, what if I make the one with the McDonald's nose first? Then is he, like, infringing my copyright?
It's great. It's fascinating. So do you feel like, as far as getting the project, you know, the website and the factory up, do you feel completed about that aspect of it?
Yeah, the factory is up and running. You know, now we just need to start manufacturing some, start selling some rocket parts.
Right. And that's why we're I got the first interview with you, Eric.
That's
no, right. I'm that's really great. Excited to see what happens with this. This is a journey. We'll have to right now it's a big open question mark as to how your project and his project are evolving, right?
That's right. They're both still in progress. So
when did his go live?
I think it was about a year ago now.
Mm-hmm. So he's had a head start. So he's got
He
sold a few.
It was also sort of funny about, like, you know, trying to find, like, images of the rock. You know, like, I mean, I had to really play detective because there aren't a lot of, like, pictures of these things out there other than, like, when he does a launch, there's pictures of them, or, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
I actually on Tom's website, there's a store where he sells like books and t-shirts and stuff. And they did, they released a new set of t-shirts and they had all these photos of like his studio staff wearing them as the models. And they had like the Rocket Factory stuff in the background. I was like, oh, there's the color red that he's using for that one. Or like, you know.
Oh, that's so funny. So does he start with models, you know, factory models?
Yeah.
Toy Rocket Factory.
Estes Rocket. You can buy a bulk pack of, I think, 12 of them or 20 mm-hmm. of them or something like
this
that.
This has got to be really profitable. How much does 12 cost?
Like $100.
For 12. And what is Tom selling them for?
Well, I don't exactly know. I mean, they're, you know, it's all it's cryptocurrency art. And stuff, so it fluctuates.
Is it?
But,
oh, well, right.
To,
yeah, because they're
buy an NFT, you need crypto,
right.
Yeah.
But
Tiffany bought a Tiffany rocket from him. The Tiffany company bought one, and they apparently spent $380,000.
Holy fucking shit. Doesn't that seem crazy? And the rocket, if you went into, like, even just bought one in a store, would be worth, well, you'd pay, like, what?
Like $15 or $20. But, you know, then you'd have to build it and paint it. So that's
so then that you could probably hire, you know, you could probably hire a detailer, like a car detailer, for a lot less.
You could hire me.
I can hire you. Well, yeah. Should we talk about pricing? I don't know. I don't think people understand like art and stuff. But what is it on your website?
Go to the website. You can buy everything straight from the website. Mm-hmm. You just need dollars or PayPal. You know,
yeah, and it's nothing like 700. It's nothing like hundreds. It's a piece of art, but it's an affordable piece of art. Let's call it that.
That's right. You can get out the door for under $3,000.
Yeah. I mean, anybody that's spending money on art is clearly got a refrigerator full of food and clean clothes. So, you know, it's not, art is not a thing you need to survive. But yeah, let's we got 2 minutes left. Let's make sure that we get all the info out. Say it again. What's the website? What's your website? Do all the details that we got to get out.
I'm Eric Dorringer. My website is ericdorringer.com, and that's spelled ericdoeringer.com. And then the Rocket Factory is Eric Dorringer, rocketfactory.com. Mm-hmm. And if you find me on Instagram, there's a link in my bio.
And it's Eric Dorringer on Instagram, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. Anything else? Or I'll just tell them about the station.
Tell them about the station. Tell them about your stuff. Remind them to go see you.
Oh, come on, guys. If you have nothing to do this weekend, on Saturday, you can go to 56 Bogart Street and see my installation called What Do You Think of My Work? Starring a sex doll, Sky Cleary, who is also a stripper.
You know, Lisa, I heard your promo about that, you know, at the top of the show, and I love that it's this used sex doll from a therapist. Like, how many dudes do you think she's been with?
I think she's monogamous. I think she was monogamous. But, you know, it's interesting. A bunch of men have commented on that. I think it makes men much more uncomfortable than women. The idea that the doll...
We're all ashamed that we have one in our closet.
Yeah, right? I don't know. Men are somehow like... I think men look at it as a sexual... Like, ew, I could touch that. Whereas, like, to me, it's just... It's... You know, it doesn't have huge tits or anything. It's very modest, so don't right. worry about it. But
but it's experienced. It's not a virgin.
That's right. So anyway, thank you for listening to Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. I'm here every week. I've got archives.